From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I was told he was still alive when they tied him to the back of that truck and drug him through the streets of Fallujah. And that was before they decapitated him, dismembered him, and torched him.
Katie Helvenston. Her son was a private soldier ambushed and killed in Fallujah in 2004. On Wednesday, she testified in Congress and faced the company she holds responsible, Blackwater USA. Then Congressmember Henry Waxman grills former Iraq proconsul Paul Bremer on the misuse of Reconstruction money in Iraq.
Well, the question this committee is trying to answer is what happened to the money? Was it spent responsibly? Was it misspent? Was it wasted? Did it go off to pay? Did it go to pay off corrupt officials? Or, worst of all, did some of this money get in the hands of the insurgents and those who are fighting us today in Iraq?
Finally, were Israeli agents tracking the 9/11 hijackers in the United States before September 11th? It's not our exclusive. ABC's 2020 and the Jewish newspaper The Forward did it. Salon also covered the story. But where's the follow-up? We'll speak with three reporters who've been tracking the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. There are new hopes of an agreement with North Korea today as international talks resume. Earlier today, a North Korean envoy said North Korea is prepared to discuss first-stage measures towards nuclear disarmament. There's speculation North Korea will propose to freeze nuclear activities and resume inspections in exchange for energy aid and normalize relations with the United States. The court-martial of the first U.S. Army officer to refuse to fight in Iraq has ended in a mistrial. On Wednesday, a military judge halted the case against First Lieutenant Aaron Watada over possible inconsistencies in a pretrial agreement Watada made with prosecutors. A new court-martial has been set for next month. More on this story after headlines. In Iraq, the Pentagon has confirmed the deaths of seven U.S. soldiers in Wednesday's helicopter crash near Baghdad. The deaths come as the Pentagon disclosed another crash. This time, a helicopter belonging to an unnamed security firm in Baghdad last week. Six U.S. helicopters have now been downed in the last 3 weeks. In other news from Iraq, Iraq's health minister has been arrested as part of the new U.S.-Iraqi crackdown on Baghdad. The minister, Hakim al-Zamili, is part of anti-occupation Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's political bloc. Military officials say Zamili helped move weapons using Iraqi ambulances. Sadr's group says the U.S. military is trying to provoke a confrontation. As U.S. and Iraqi forces step up raids throughout Baghdad, Iraqi Parliament Speaker Mahmoud al-Mashadani described the crackdown as the last chance for the U.S. occupation.
This plan is the last-ditch effort by the U.S. administration and the new Iraqi political system. If the plan failed, the Iraqi project of the U.S. administration would fail and the whole Iraqi political project would fall to pieces.
In other Iraq news, the Iraqi government has asked Parliament to take legal action against the pan-Arab satellite news network Al Jazeera. In a statement, Iraq's cabinet said Al Jazeera's coverage is contributing to spreading death and destruction in Iraq. The move comes 2 years after the Iraqi government banned Al Jazeera from reporting in Iraq. In response, Al Jazeera editor-in-chief Ahmed Sheikh said, quote, "The Iraqi government is looking for a scapegoat to justify their failure in bringing security and stability to Iraqis." In other Iraq news, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has issued a new appeal for more international support in Iraq's worsening refugee crisis. Antonio Guterres spoke Wednesday in Jordan.
When you have almost 4 million people displaced, half of it inside the country, half of it in the countries around, you are facing a humanitarian disaster. And it's very important to mobilize the international community to fully support the people in need, but also to fully support countries that have very generously accepted them, like Jordan, like Syria, like others, and that need a massive solidarity from the international community.
An estimated 2 million Iraqis have fled to neighboring countries, more than half to Jordan and Syria. In Italy, a U.S. soldier has been ordered to stand trial for the deadly shooting of Italian intelligence agent Nicola Calipari in Iraq. Calipari was escorting the Italian reporter Giuliana Screna out of Iraq following her release from month-long abduction. The soldier, Mario Lozano, of the 69th Infantry Regiment here in New York, is likely to be tried in absentia. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Juliana Screna welcomed the trial, saying, quote, "It's important because Italy showed its sovereignty in the face of the impunity of American soldiers. It's not only a symbolic trial, but an important trial for me because I think we can find out the truth," Screna said. In Mecca, leaders of the Palestinian factions Fatah and Hamas say they're moving forward in talks on ending internal fighting. This is Nabil Amer, media advisor to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
I cannot say we really reach a final agreement about all the issues, but we are on the way to reach this agreement. The atmosphere here in Mecca encouraged the Palestinians to go ahead, and I'm sure that maybe we will reach the conclusion within 48 hours maximum.
More than 90 people have been killed in less than 2 months of Palestinian factional violence. In Bolivia, President Evo Morales has reached an agreement with striking miners over a tax increase on the mining industry. On Wednesday, Morales said the tax will only apply to large companies.
We must strengthen and give power to all the work sectors, because this government is for all the social movements. As one of you explained, we have been part of the process of change, and we must continue.
Back in the United States, seven Republican senators who voted to block discussion on the non-binding measure opposing the escalation of the Iraq war are now claiming they'll use all measures to ensure an open debate. In a letter released Wednesday, Senators John Warner of Virginia, Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, and five others said they'll attach their pledge for debate to any proposal hitting the Senate floor in the coming weeks. In other news from Capitol Hill, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee Wednesday. In a controversial moment, Rice denied ever seeing an Iranian proposal calling for dialogue with the United States on issues including nuclear activity and possible recognition of Israel. The 2003 overture was revealed by The Washington Post last year. Former administration officials, including one of Rice's aides, have said the proposal was rejected. Rice was also asked about Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
I do believe that the president of Venezuela is really, really destroying his own country, economically, politically. This is a place with which we've had traditionally very good relations and would like to continue to have good relations.
In Washington, Louis Scooter Libby's defense has received a major blow from both a key witness and a recording of Libby's own words. Dick Cheney's former chief of staff is accused of lying to investigators and a grand jury during the investigation of the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. On Wednesday, NBC News correspondent Tim Russert testified he did not tell Libby about Plame's identity. Russert's testimony came after the jury heard a recording of an exchange in which Libby tells Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald he did not know of Plame's identity until he spoke to Russert. On the tape, Libby describes to Fitzgerald what he says Russert told him.
Did you know that his wife worked for the CIA?
And you said,
No, I don't know that.
And his response?
All the reporters know.
And your response?
No, I don't know that.
Louis Scooter Libby being questioned by prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald. The retail giant Walmart is among a new alliance of business and labor unions to call for universal health care. On Wednesday, Walmart joined with AT&T, Intel, the Service Employees International Union, and others to call for universal coverage by the year 2012. They did not give specific policy proposals. Walmart says businesses are paying an unfair share of health care costs. Despite the alliance, the Service Employees International Union, known as SEIU, says its funding of the group Walmart Watch will continue. In a statement, another watch group, Wake Up Walmart, said, quote, "If Walmart is truly serious about universal health care, we challenge it to provide universal health care to all its uninsured employees and make universal health care a litmus test for its political contributions. We await their answer." And finally, the Pentagon has cleared five service members recently accused of abusing prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. But critics are pointing to one problem. Investigators didn't speak to any of the alleged victims. The probe was ordered after a Marine sergeant made public allegations of abuse she says she heard directly from the soldiers who carried it out. Marine Corps Sergeant Heather Cerveny said five service members told her they regularly beat Guantanamo prisoners. The investigator, Colonel Richard Bassett, said he conducted 20 interviews with, quote, suspects and witnesses. The military has not explained why prisoners were excluded. Colonel Bassett recommended no disciplinary action against the accused guards. He did, however, accuse the whistleblower, Sergeant Cerveny, of filing a false statement during his investigation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We turn now to the court-martial of U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. He's the first officer to refuse deployment to Iraq. On Wednesday, the Army judge declared a mistrial. Geoffrey Millard of truthout.org filed this report from Fort Lewis in Washington.
On the start of day three of the Lieutenant Aaron Watada court-martial, no one could have predicted a mistrial. But instead of Lieutenant Watada taking the stand, that is exactly what happened. Immediately after the judge's decision, the Army held a press conference trying to make sense of the day's events.
This afternoon, the military judge, presiding over the general court-martial, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, declared a mistrial. Earlier today, the judge rejected a stipulation of fact that had been signed during pretrial negotiations by both the prosecution and defense. As a result, this case could not go forward because the parties were relying on evidence that was contained in that stipulation of fact.
It appears from what was presented in court today that both the defense and the prosecution agreed to those sets of facts, and that that set of facts, that agreement that they had, still allowed for the defense and the government to present additional evidence or argument on defenses and other issues. The military judge was concerned, however, that the way that the stipulation was written amounted to Lieutenant Watada confessing to that offense of missing movement when it was clear his intent was not to do that. Basically, all stipulations of fact are agreements between the parties of a certain list of facts that they agree are true and will be uncontroverted in trial. So it could be any facts that they, of course, reach agreement upon. What becomes confessional about that is if, within the stipulation of fact, all of the elements of a particular offense are covered in this stipulation, meaning without pleading guilty, you have an accused who basically is admitting all the elements of an offense without pleading guilty.
The defense and their supporters saw things differently and held a separate press conference to explain their point of view.
In this case, it is my professional opinion that Lieutenant Watada cannot be tried again because of the effect of double jeopardy. Our hope is at this point that the Army will realize that this case is a hopeless mess. The first motion we file when they attempt to bring this case back will be a motion to dismiss with prejudice based upon double jeopardy. And if that motion is not granted, we will immediately take an interlocutory appeal because we believe that even the military appellate courts will agree with us that the circumstances under which the judge acted today were an abuse of his discretion and that there was no justification whatsoever either for the subject inquiry to be brought up in the manner in which it was, for the additional inquiry of Lieutenant Watada, in which he elicited statements which he then purported to utilize to criticize and withdraw the stipulation of facts to which the government and the defense had agreed last week when two of the charges were dismissed in return for our agreement that we would stipulate to facts to avoid the necessity for reporters to testify. We are now in a position because of the government and rulings by the court that we think are erroneous and will have the consequence of ending these proceedings altogether.
As Attorney Eric Seitz said, the government's case, the Army's case against Lieutenant Watada is a mess. And this case reflects the mess that the administration is in Iraq also.
I just want to say that I continue to remain very hopeful that my son will be exonerated. He has committed no crime and I believe should not be punished.
The stipulation of fact, now the judge all of a sudden today started referring to it as a confessional stipulation of fact. Why was it to him all of a sudden a confessional stipulation of fact and to you, and it appeared to the prosecution, still just a stipulation of fact?
I don't know what the judge is talking about. This stipulation didn't change from last week when we ran it past the judge and he approved it. It didn't change from Monday when he went through it in detail, line by line, with Aaron and then approved it. And it didn't change from yesterday when he went through it again because he had some issues about it. The judge acted on his own for his own reasons, and I frankly don't understand any more than the government counsel does what his thinking was or what his legal basis was, because I don't believe there was any.
Eric, is this a victory for you with a mistrial?
We think it may become a very significant victory, depending upon what happens between now and the next time we go back to court. My firm belief professionally is that the consequence of granting a mistrial over our wishes means that because jeopardy attached, that the case cannot be retried. I don't know that the judge realizes that. I'm not sure that government counsel appreciates that or the spokespeople for the Army today. But in my experience and based upon my professional judgment, there is a very strong likelihood that they cannot retry this case. And if it is, in fact, the end of this case, then yes, that's a very significant event and a terrific victory.
It remains to be seen whether this will be a victory or a defeat for the prosecution or for the defense. This has been Jeff Millard reporting for truthout.org from Fort Lewis, Washington.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. The private security company Blackwater admitted on Tuesday for the first time that one of its employees shot and killed an Iraqi guard inside the Green Zone in December. Blackwater removed its worker from Iraq on the next day before criminal charges could be filed. The case raises new questions about whether contractors can be held legally accountable for misconduct. Congressman Dennis Kucinich questioned Blackwater's general counsel, Andrew Howell, during a congressional hearing on the role of private contractors in Iraq.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to submit for the record a story that was in the January 11, 2007 edition of the Pilot newspaper. And it relates to, the headline says, Iraq killing tracked to contractor could test laws. Now, the question is this, Mr. Howe, are you familiar with a December 24th shooting involving one of your employees who shot and killed an Iraqi security officer? And are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with some aspects of it, yes, sir.
Did your company order that man back to the States?
That gentleman, on the day the incident occurred, he was off duty. Blackwater did bring him back to the United States, and our client also understandably directed that he be off the project immediately. His security clearance was revoked, and there is other activity going on, sir.
Is he going to be extradited back to Iraq for murder? And if not, why not?
Sir, I am not law enforcement. All I can say is that there is currently an investigation by, as I understand it, the FBI and the Department of Justice of the incident that day, and we are fully cooperating and supporting that investigation. And what action they'll take, sir, I can't say.
But
thank
wait,
you, Mr. Kucinich, because Mr. Welch has been waiting. And if you have further questions, if you would submit it in writing.
Critics of Blackwater have complained its employees are not accountable under Iraqi or U.S. law. Wednesday's hearing on private contractors began with testimony from the relatives of the four Blackwater contractors who were brutally murdered in Fallujah in March of 2004. After being shot, the men's bodies were dragged through the streets and mutilated. Two of the corpses were strung from a bridge. The families of the four men are now suing Blackwater, alleging the men were sent into Fallujah unprepared.
A day before the men died, a co-worker wrote an email to company officials urging them to send new equipment to Iraq. The content of the email was released yesterday. It read in part, quote, I need new vehicles. I need ammo. I need Glocks and M4s. All the client body armor you got. Guys are in the field with borrowed stuff and in harm's way. Henry Waxman, the chair of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, questioned Blackwater's general counsel about the email.
Three issues and questions, whether the vehicles were hardened sufficiently to protect them, whether they had the ammunition, the ammunition and equipment needed to protect themselves. And thirdly, the question also is whether they had a third person to be a tail gunner. Can you tell us whether they had what they needed in all three of those areas?
Yes, sir. With regards to the armored vehicle question, there was certainly desire to have some sort of armored vehicles on this project, meaning the ESS project as a whole. But again, it doesn't follow therefrom that each mission involved an armored vehicle. And in fact, close review of the contracts reveal that it was specifically contemplated that there would be other vehicles which had some sort of protection added that would be used on the project. Beyond that, the armored vehicle question, the vehicle that they went out in that day was believed appropriate based on the mission by everyone involved, or the mission, I don't believe that it would have been carried out at that point. And the armored vehicle, whether it would have affected the events of that day is another question. With regard to the third person, the protocol for the type of mission the men were on that day, and again, we're bordering on things that could involve operational security of not only our folks but service members. The mission they were on that day, at that point in time, given the threat it was known on the ground in Iraq, the norm was not to have the third person.
Okay. Well, Mr. Powell, obviously in his email, was expressing concern. I guess my general question is, when Blackwater sends private forces into a war zone, do you have an obligation to equip them adequately? And I assume you would have to say yes. Then my next question is, did Blackwater meet this obligation in Fallujah?
Yes, we did.
Okay. I just want to conclude by reading this quote again. But guys are in this field with borrowed stuff and in harm's way with the client, to which I'm very uncomfortable with, given the upcoming events with 5 million Shia moving in Karbala in 5 days. I've requested hard cars from the beginning, and from my understanding, an order is still pending. Why, I ask.
Henry Waxman, chair of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, questioning Andrew Howell, the general counsel for Blackwater. Wednesday's hearing began with testimony from Katie Helvenston. Her son Scott was killed in Fallujah. We'll come back to her after break. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS TV stations. We also broadcast on both TV satellite networks, on DirecTV, Channel 375, which is Link TV, and also on Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV and 9410 Link TV. We're going to go back to break, then we'll come back. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wednesday's hearing began with testimony from Katie Helvenston. Her son, Scott Helvenston, was one of the four Blackwater employees killed in Fallujah. Katie joins us now from Washington, D.C. With us here in our firehouse studio is Jeremy Scahill. He's a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute and author of the forthcoming book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Before we go to Katie, Jeremy, can you just talk about the significance of this hearing that was chaired by Henry Waxman in Washington yesterday?
Well, this was an extraordinary development in a story that that really began on March 31st, 2004, when the four Blackwater private soldiers were ambushed and killed in Fallujah. Some of their lifeless bodies hung from a bridge. And it was really a moment that turned the war. The Iraqi resistance exploded. The U.S. laid siege to Fallujah, killing hundreds and hundreds of people, displacing tens of thousands of others, destroying some 90,000 buildings inside the city of Fallujah. And it really defined the era that now exists in Iraq. And an extraordinary thing that has come of this is that the families of these four men who were killed, on the one hand, yes, they hold the Iraqis who killed their loved ones responsible, but more than that, they hold Blackwater responsible. They say that their men were sent in there without appropriate armor, personnel, weapons. Well, 3 years later, they are still in the process of suing Blackwater. Blackwater hasn't turned any documents over to them and refuses to give them any answers as to what happened that day. And yesterday was yet another extraordinary turn of events. Blackwater was essentially pulled kicking and screaming in front of Henry Waxman's committee. See, Blackwater enjoyed this Republican monopoly on government for so long. It kept them away from these kinds of hearings for the most part. And yesterday, they were finally forced to face their accusers for the first time. And Blackwater's legal counsel, Andrew Howell, was in the gallery during the testimony of Katie Helvenston and others. Just one point. This really, what we've seen, is an undeclared surge over the last several years, where the Bush administration has deployed some 100,000 contractors. According to the Government Accountability Office, 48,000 people work for private security firms in Iraq. I would call them mercenary firms. And so really, as Congress debates the surge, we have this undeclared surge. And what we really saw yesterday was a human face on the real crisis that has been created with this unprecedented privatization agenda in Iraq.
You talk about the very Republican-connected firm, Blackwater. Actually, that was an issue in yesterday's hearing.
Well, the Republicans sort of, rather than really paying close attention to what the relatives of these four men killed were saying, chose to focus on sort of two primary things. One, they were accusing the law firm Callahan and Blaine from Santa Ana, California, that represents these four families in the lawsuit against Blackwater, of being some kind of Democrat powerhouse law firm. And what's ironic about it is that Dan Callahan, the owner of the firm, has actually given more money to Republicans than Democrats. And then the second thing that they focus on, they called it a legislative show trial and a sort of payola scheme, where somehow Dan Callahan had orchestrated this hearing because he's given $3,000 to Democratic candidates. But then the other side of it is that several congresspeople tried to make the point with Blackwater, you know, you're accused by the lawyers for these families of being an extremely Republican company. And of course, Andy Howell said that's not true. We have people of all political stripes. Well, I've obtain the campaign finance records of the leading figures at Blackwater. They have just given buku bucks to Republican campaigns, never a penny to a Democrat, but money to the Green Party to defeat Democrats. So there's no question. Blackwater is as Republican and right-wing Republican as a company could get, and basically their heyday is over. You know, Henry Waxman is the chair of this committee, and you know, when they say to him, it's classified information, Waxman points out to them, he's the congressman and they're the private company.
Katie Helvenston in Washington, you were among the family members who gave powerful testimony in the hearing yesterday. What did you tell the members of Congress, and how did you feel they responded to your concerns?
I feel, generally speaking, they responded very well. There was one gentleman, I'm not sure what state he was from, he definitely gave me a hard time, and I didn't appreciate it too much.
I think that was Chris Shays of Connecticut, well,
no,
as I recall.
Chris Shays was actually, he gave me a little bit of a hard time, but it was the guy, the dark-headed guy. I don't know where he was from.
Katie Helvenston, are you referring to Daryl Issa from California?
Yes,
who raised some questions about your testimony.
Yes, that's his name. Had a short night. I apologize for my voice. I've got laryngitis. So just bear with me.
Katie, can you talk about why you testified and why you're suing Blackwater USA?
Well, my ultimate goal is it's definitely not the money. I will not receive a penny. I would like to make sure that Blackwater never gets another government contract. And
why?
They're corrupt. They do not care for their employees' lives. Every decision they make is based on the dollar. And for every employee that dies, they're replaced by 10 more within minutes. They're standing in line to take these jobs, not knowing that the harm's way that they're going to be put in.
Jeremy Scahill, Daralisa taking on these family members who lost loved ones in Fallujah, the four Blackwater employee families. Explain what happened.
Well, what happened is that Representative Jan Schakowsky, who really has been one of the leading proponents of implementing some sort of system of contractor oversight and reform, is not on the committee, but she was allowed to sit in on the hearings. And during the course of his questioning, Daralisa chose to make his sort of prize issue at the beginning, who wrote the statement that Katie Helvenston delivered during the hearing yesterday. And the statement, of course, was a compilation of the thoughts of all four of the families, and then was pulled together. But what ISA was saying is your lawyer wrote this for you, didn't he? And so Jan Schakowsky objected to that, and she said, you know, this is basically reprehensible that you would suggest that these four women wouldn't be able to put together their own statement. And she basically condemned his statement. But while she was condemning ISA's statement, ISA had left the room. He kept going in and out, in and out. And so he wasn't even there to hear the entirety of Jan Schakowsky's remarks. So he flies back into the room after an aide tells him that Schakowsky had said something about him. And without knowing exactly what she had said, he erroneously characterizes what Jan Schakowsky had actually said about him, and then demands that Schakowsky's remarks be stricken from the record.
And Katie Helvenston, when Congressman Kucinich questioned the attorney for Blackwater about the killing of an Iraqi security guard in the Green Zone, to what degree have the families been at least attempting to unearth some of this information that you've gotten and passing it on to these members of Congress so that they have some knowledge, basic knowledge of what's going on?
Well, I was made aware of the murder a couple days after Christmas. It was kind of strange because they were typewritten letters. They weren't computer, and I had no idea who was sending it to me. And, you know, I passed it on. This Blackwater employee shot this Iraqi guard 11 times. And it turned out he was security for the vice president of Iraq. And I was told that this employee, Blackwater, was just whisked out of the country, never to be seen from since. I was amazed that there was only one article that I was aware of that addressed this. No one else would address it. And I was so pleased that it got out in testimony yesterday. It is now a matter of record because I really thought they were going to succeed sweeping it under the rug.
You know, Amy and Juan, this is actually a very important development in this story. Bill Sizemore, the Virginian pilot, was the reporter who really stuck his neck out and published this. There were a number of us working on the story, but we weren't able to confirm from official sources and only through unofficial sources that it was, in fact, a Blackwater contractor involved. And so when Congressman Kucinich rushed in at the very end of the hearing, he submitted that Virginian pilot article for the record, and then he asked, now, mind you, no one has actually confirmed, other than through unnamed unofficial sources, that it was a Blackwater contractor that shot an Iraqi guard in Baghdad on December 24th. And so Kucinich asks Howell if he's aware of it, and we heard the clip earlier. And it was the confirmation that all of us, all the journalists, had been looking for from Blackwater, and we'd been being stonewalled. The Blackwater spokespeople have been saying, no comment, no comment. And so now, Blackwater's own legal counsel, you should have seen the lobbyists when this happened, squirming in their seats when Andrew Howell confirmed what Blackwater has been stonewalling all
and
these
the circumstances
weeks.
Circumstances of this murder?
Well, we don't know. I mean, it's very shady right now. What we understand from a mixture of the news reports, the U.S. Embassy, and now Andrew Howell, is that this individual, this Blackwater contractor, was allegedly off duty. We understand there may have been some alcohol involved with it. And as Katie says, the reports indicate that he may have been shot. He may have shot this Iraqi guard as many as 11 times. But what's important for people to understand is that there's no statute of limitations on murder in the United States. And what the U.S. has done is totally gutted Iraqi law. So the Iraqi government, we understand, wanted to go after this guy and prosecute him. He killed a security guard for a senior Iraqi official, allegedly. And so when the Iraqi government started making rumblings that they potentially would prosecute him, well, he gets whisked out of the country by Blackwater. And, you know, Kucinich asks, is he going to be extradited to Iraq for murder? Andy Howell fumbles through, I'm not law enforcement, mentions something about the FBI. See, this is the very heart of what's wrong with the privatization of this war right now. There is a culture of impunity in Iraq. These guys are killed, and their numbers don't get counted, and they kill people, and they don't get prosecuted.
We want to thank you, Katie Helvenston, for being with us, mother of Scott, who was killed in Fallujah, one of the four whose story was shown all over the world. As we continue on the issue of reconstruction, so-called, and private armies, we will continue with Jeremy Scahill, and we'll also be joined by Prothap Chatterjee. Juan?
Yes, the Justice Department has indicted three former Army officers and two civilians. They're accused of diverting $3.6 million in Iraqi reconstruction money to a contractor in exchange for cash, luxury cars, and jewelry. The announcement came one day after the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform held a hearing about how billions of dollars set aside for the Iraq reconstruction have gone missing. The committee's chair, Henry Waxman, questioned Paul Bremer, former administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority.
Little more than a year, $12 billion in U.S. currency removed from the vaults of the Federal Reserve and flown into Iraq. This money, mainly $100 bills, were packed into bricks, and each brick was worth $400,000 each. And I think we have a picture of the bricks on the screen. They were assembled into large pallets containing over $60 million in cash and flown into Iraq. In December 2003, Ambassador Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority asked for a shipment of $1.5 billion to be flown into Iraq. And a Federal Reserve official described this in an email as the largest payout of U.S. currency in U.S. history. But this didn't remain the largest for very long, because in June, $2.4 billion was sent to Iraq, and this time a Federal Reserve official wrote, quote, just when you think you've seen it all, the CPA is ordering $2,401,600,000 in currency. Well, the question this committee is trying to answer is what happened to the money? Was it spent responsibly? Was it misspent? Was it wasted? Did it go to pay off corrupt officials? Or, worst of all, did some of this money get in the hands of the insurgents and those who are fighting us today in Iraq? Ambassador Bremer, are you concerned about the possibility that some of this money went to ghost employees, we don't know where it went, and might be showing up in the hands of insurgents that are fighting U.S. troops?
If there were evidence of that, I would certainly be concerned.
We don't know whether there's evidence of it.
We don't know
whether the people who got the money were entitled to it or what they did with it.
Well, as the Inspector General pointed out, the problem of ghost employees was certainly there, and it was there even before the invasion. But I have no knowledge of monies being diverted. I would certainly be concerned if I thought they were.
Well, $12 billion is a lot of money. It could have been used for a lot of projects that American taxpayers ended up funding through our appropriations. It seems to me inconceivable that we can't explain what happened to it, but that seems to be the situation we're in.
Congressmember Henry Waxman questioning the former Iraq proconsul Paul Bremer. Investigative journalist Prothap Chatterjee attended Tuesday's hearing and joins us now from Washington, D.C. He's managing editor of CorpWatch.org and author of Iraq, Inc., A Profitable Occupation. Can you talk about the significance of this hearing and what Paul Bremer said, Prothap?
Amy, this is a very important hearing. This hearing yesterday was the first of what Henry Waxman promises will be 2 years of hearings. And they're going to be looking into corruption, waste, and abuse in Iraq, and also, for example, in border surveillance. Today's hearing is going to look at the money being spent on protecting the border, ostensibly. What they were talking about yesterday, and what Paul Bremer was on the stand to talk about, was the $19.6 billion worth of Iraq's money that the Coalition Provisional Authority spent in Iraq and squandered much of it. Denis Kucinich at one point held up a piece of paper and said, Mr. Bremer, what happened to this $500 million, which says for security TBD, to be determined? And in fact, there were no answers. Partly it's because Bremer had not been briefed, and so he didn't recognize the piece of paper. But I think what was more telling was the fact that he said, I never read those minutes. There were meetings twice a week of U.S. officials where they decided how to spend Iraq's own oil money. And Paul Bremer, who ultimately was responsible for that, candidly admitted at the hearing yesterday that he didn't know what happened to the money. His assistant, David Oliver, was present. He was his budget chief. And there was a quote played back where he was interviewed where somebody asked him from the BBC if he knew what happened to the money. And he said, frankly, it's not important. And the interviewer said, billions of dollars worth of money and you don't know where it went? And so they said, well, you know, this wasn't American money. Why should we care? And that really there was, Paul Bremer had this sort of cocksure attitude that came across. The Democrats, unfortunately, didn't have all their facts marshaled. They weren't able to go after him in that sense because they weren't really involved in the detailed kind of questioning that Waxman has been good on so far. So,
and Pertha, of course, they obviously haven't been reading your Corp Watch, or they would know what questions to ask.
But, if they had, yes.
But I'd like to ask you also, you've been also tracking Halliburton consistently now for years. The reports about the Pentagon finally pulling money because Halliburton had hired Blackwater but hadn't notified the government of it.
Juan, that was a very interesting moment where Tina Ballard, who's Assistant Secretary of the Army, said in yesterday's hearing that they had withheld $19.6 million from Halliburton on Monday. And Waxman said, well, it looks like our hearing saved the government, the taxpayer, $20 million just by holding this hearing. The reason they withheld that money was because Halliburton had been using private security contractors in violation of their agreement with the Army, which said they would only use military security. So, and in fact, Halliburton's own lawyers, Waxman had a piece of paper which showed that Halliburton's own staff had said, you can't say, I mean, the quote was, a pig is a pig even if it's wearing lipstick. If we use a company that uses private security and that's a violation of our agreement, we're going to lose our contract with the government. So what the Army did yesterday was they took back $20 million because Halliburton had acted outside its agreement. Now, that was a small amount of money. And in fact, much larger sums of money have been questioned by military auditors. As much as $1.5 billion have been questioned. It's not absolutely certain this money was stolen or wasted. It's just that this money has been questioned. And unfortunately, the Army, the Pentagon has seen fit to give them the money because they basically say it's the fog of war. We don't know what happened to the money. Halliburton deserves the benefit of the doubt. The good news now is that Halliburton's contract has been taken away from them. It's going to be competitively bid. My question is, who's going to get the next contract, and are they going to do a better job? It's very possible that Halliburton will get one part of the contract to supervise the people that they were once in charge of in the first place. That's something that we'll discover in the future. But there promises to be many more hearings by the Government Reform Committee looking into these very specific matters of what happened to the over $20 billion that has been spent on
Halliburton. Pratap Chatterjee, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Managing editor of CorpWatch.org and author of Iraq, Inc., A Profitable Occupation. Also thanks to Jeremy Scahill, whose forthcoming book is coming out very soon, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Somehow, someway, someday, we gon' brothers bitch down for what they didn't upgrade.
somebody somewhere say something. I tie myself out and I ain't changed one thing. God, it looked like you ain't watched in a while. And I don't even know when's the last time I smiled. They look and feel sorry for us. Can you believe it? The great Iraq, as if we need it. And look what they decide to give us. Blood from the world to fill up our rivers. And what, we're supposed to be thankful? You killed my family and I should say thank you? No thanks, you got your tanks, I got my guard, bring it on. Bring it. It sound pretty, you can sing along, cause the sound of gunfire is my favorite song. Sing it. There's a war going on outside, no birds round here, just bullets that fly. There's a war going on outside, there's death everywhere, but I feel so alive. There's a war going on outside, no birds round here, just bullets that fly. There's a war going on outside, there's death everywhere, but I feel so alive. I feel so alive. Dear Mr. George Bush, why do you insist to make a fool of us? For over 200 years, we stood for what's good, now we despise by peers. This ain't gonna last for long, they wish us dead, George, yo, they wish us gone. And what do you do but add fuel to the fire and send in more troops?
Iraqi American rapper Times here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
With the Democrats in control of Congress for the first time in the Bush administration, the White House is finally being called to task on various aspects of the Iraq War, from the mishandling of billions in reconstruction dollars to the use of private military contractors. But there is no congressional oversight on another defining issue of the Bush presidency, 9/11. Questions remain over whether Israeli agents tracking the 9/11 hijackers were tracking the 9/11 hijackers before September 11th.
This one we can't claim is an exclusive. ABC's 2020 did this story. The Jewish newspaper The Forward also did it. Salon also covered the story. But where's the follow-up? Freelance journalist Christopher Ketchum has just published a comprehensive piece on this story in the newsletter Counterpunch. The article highlights various interconnected stories. The five Israeli movers who witnesses say were cheering after the first plane struck the World Trade Center, the so-called Israeli art students who were living in concentrated areas where hijackers were living in the United States, and how two of the hijackers ended up on the watch list weeks before 9/11. Christopher Ketchum, the author of the article, joins us online from upstate New York. Alexander Coburn also joins us on the phone. He's the editor of Counterpunch, where the piece is published. And with us here in the Firehouse studio is Mark Perlman. He is the reporter who did one of the first reports on the story for the newspaper The Forward in 2002. Why don't we begin with Christopher Ketchum? Christopher, start off with the story you begin with in this latest piece. And that's the story of the five so-called movers, this story that has been documented, talked about, rumored about. Explain what happened that morning of 9/11.
Sure. Let me just preface this whole conversation just to say that the Counterpunch article does not pretend to provide readers with a definitive smoking gun for these allegations. Rather, what I've done is gathered all the available information on the matter, that is the disparate media reports that you mentioned, leaked documents from FBI, CIA, and the Justice Department, conversations with former intelligence officials and current FBI officers. Now, the upshot of all this available evidence is this. The Israeli government likely was conducting some kind of spy operation on U.S. soil in the run-up to the September 11th attacks. The purpose of the operation was to identify and track Muslim extremists, possibly including members of al-Qaeda. Now, the best evidence that we have for this is, in fact, the story of these five moving men. Now, three of these guys were seen on the morning of September 11th, just after the first plane hit the North Tower, quote-unquote celebrating on the New Jersey waterfront. Now, I put the quotes around that because it comes from a FBI BOLO, or Be On Lookout, an alert that was put out regarding these men that day. The celebration apparently consisted of high-fiving, according to one FBI official, of holding up cigarette lighters as if they're at a rock concert. So remember, the plane has just hit the tower, exploded in the tower, and these three men are behaving rather oddly. Later in the day, they were picked up. Two other men had apparently joined them in a van. They were the case was immediately handed over to FBI counterintelligence. The men were held for 71 days. They were repeatedly interrogated. They were they failed lie detector tests, and then after those 71 days was up, they were sent home, apparently under pressure, or because of pressure brought by the Israeli government and by certain players in the U.S. government, and the story sort of disappeared from there. I mean, 2020 covered this.
Chris Ketchum, you say, you quote the officer who arrested them, named DiCarlo. You say, according to DiCarlo's report, this officer was told without question by the driver of the moving van, Sivan Kurzberg, "We are Israeli. We are not your problem. Your problems are our problems. The Palestinians are the problem."
Right. Well, what's interesting there is that, you recall after the first plane hit, no one really thought that this was a terrorist attack. I mean, most people thought, and I was there, you know, on the Brooklyn waterfront watching this whole thing, everyone thought it was an accident. These guys, when they were interrogated by FBI, told them that, essentially said that they immediately knew it was a terrorist attack. And they actually told FBI that the reason they were celebrating was because the attacks would be beneficial to Israel, that it was a, quote, a good thing for Israel. That's according to the FBI spokesman who spoke on the record about this. And that it would bring sympathy for the Israel's political agenda in the Middle East.
And if I can interrupt, I'd like to bring in Mark Perlman to the conversation. Mark, it was your newspaper that the Forward that first broke the story that the FBI thought that at least a couple of these people were Mossad agents. Could you talk about that and how you uncovered that information?
Yes, we ended up writing a story in March of 2002 after several months of reporting, because when this incident happened, obviously a lot of people were intrigued, including journalists. And so everybody was trying to find more information about this. And I've been talking to sources and trying to find out a little bit more. And after a while, I was able to confirm that, according to the FBI, two of those movers were identified as Mossad agents. And they were interrogated about it. Obviously, the circumstances around the interrogation, there was a lot of panic after 9/11. People were looking for suspects everywhere. So the reports about exactly how they were behaving and what they said, we should be a little bit careful about this.
Right.
Because and so what I tried to do is go beyond the reports about them smiling and high-fiving and so on, because I had my doubts about this. I still have them, by the way. And so what I did was try to back up the information I had, that they were indeed recognized as Mossad agents who were essentially tracking a Muslim activist in the New York, New Jersey area, which was known to be active since the mid-90s. And so that we eventually were able to piece the story together and go with it.
And what eventually happened to the five men?
They were sent home to Israel in, I think, November, if I remember, allegedly for immigration violations. And they're home.
We don't have much time, and I wanted to get to another story, which was a story of the so-called art students, Christopher Ketchum. Very briefly, outline this parallel story.
Basically, the phenomenon of the art students, for want of a better phrase, because it is truly a mystery. Even to me, I'm a complete agnostic about this part of the story. These so-called art students were young Israeli men and women who were traveling the country. They were identified by the Drug Enforcement Agency as repeatedly attempting to penetrate government offices, including DEA offices, and to try to sell art, these cheap knockoff oil paintings, to government officials. Now, after September 11th, in the wake of the sudden attacks, investigators began to go back and look at the nexus of art student activity with the nexuses of the activities of the future hijackers, or the 9/11 hijackers. And what they found was that the art students, in many cases, were living in very close proximity to these September 11 hijackers. Many of these art students were moving large amounts of cash. Some of them were reportedly, according to Le Monde, carrying cell phones provided them by the vice consul, an Israeli vice consul in the U.S. Many of them were trained, highly trained in electronic intercept and intelligence work that was far beyond the compulsory military training required by Israeli law. So these are part of the suspicions were aroused, and they remain so.
Suspicions that they were tracking the hijackers.
That's correct.
Let's go to Alexander Coburn. You have published this piece. It is titled Cheering Movers and Art Student Spies, What Did Israel Know in Advance of the 9/11 Attacks? Who were the Israelis living next to Mohammed Atta? What was in the van on the New Jersey shore? How did two hijackers land on watch list weeks before 9/11? Who shut down Fox News' Carl Cameron? We just have 2 minutes, but talk about the way the media has covered this, why you chose to cover it, and that last story of Fox.
The main thing, Amy, is that basically this story, which Perlman and others did good work on, has been systematically suppressed by the media for a very long time, starting with Fox News, which killed off Cameron, the ABC News, which dropped it, and obviously there were thousands of questions which Ketchum goes into in great detail, which should be the subject of congressional hearings and investigations, such as was the Mossad essentially being subcontracted by the CIA to work in the United States on spying, which would be illegal. How much did the Israelis really know? If it was a good thing for Israel, maybe they withheld the final news that the thing was going to land. That's a speculation, of course, but it should be investigated and probed. It's absolutely extraordinary that Ketchum's story, which has been worked on, which is a very long and complex story, could not find any outlet until a counterpunch, which is what we're here for, could publish it. It's obviously the main reason is the word Israel. People drop it like a hot potato. As soon as you hear people saying it's a good thing for Israel, you get the whole lobby came in and had those people whipped out of the jail and sent back to Israel. And since then, all questions regarding it had been systematically choked off. I think that's the sort of, you know, journalistic powder keg.
Alexander, this story that you've published first was going to go to Salon.com, then The Nation.
That's what I understand from Christopher. Yes, that's true.
Christopher Ketchum.
The editors didn't feel that there was any news here.
And I'd like to ask Mark Perlman, were you surprised when the 9/11 Commission report came out that there was no mention of at all in the reports of a possible knowledge by Israeli agents in this country of the attacks or tracking of some of these suspects?
Yes and no. I mean, I was surprised because since there have been questions that are still being asked now, that at least the commission would address the issue even to debunk it. That being said, my reporting was narrow, was about those movers and what they were doing. And the conclusion was that they were essentially spying on radical activists in the region and that they had been let go because the American authorities had determined that they did not have foreknowledge of the attacks, which is different than what the article says, because it implies that they were essentially shipped to Israel because of the Israel lobby and because they knew. Whereas what I have been able to find out is that they were sent home because they did something they were not supposed to do and without the knowledge of the American government, which is an issue, obviously, that should be discussed publicly.
That the Israelis were spying on U.S. soil.
Right, without the approval of the U.S. authorities. Sometimes friendly governments have agreements where they can kind of like spy together. Apparently, this was a case where it was not happening.
Mark, we're going to have to leave it there. Mark Perlman of The Forward, which is based in New York. Christopher Ketchum, freelance journalist, author of this latest piece that appears in Counterpunch. Alexander Coburn, thanks also for joining us, editor of Counterpunch Newsletter. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fudoka Deuce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Lee Bjork, Jen Utes, Anna Nagara, Anuradha Bhagwati. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.